time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for April 27, 2019, and it's sort of a mini milestone. It's show number 450. Tonight I welcome three guests, two of whom you know and one you don't. First up, it's time to check in with our man in the pro-no, Dan Worry. With the Spring Classics well underway, Dan will talk with us about some of the big stories from the cobbles, what's going on with our world champ Peter Sagan, and more. Then it's a warm welcome back to retired pro and fierce women's advocate Inga Thompson. Inga and I have been planning to chat for some time, but we needed to wait until one of her new projects was in place. The Inga Thompson Foundation, which is a not-for-profit enterprise, has launched with the goal of enabling women's cycling with support of promising riders. It is especially timely because after last week's article about Rebecca Twigg, Inga has also dedicated a piece of her work to helping Rebecca. We'll talk all about it in a bit. Then, as promised, we have the first of our four-part series on injuries that many cyclists face with orthopedic sports specialist Dr. Jonathan Hirsch. Dr. Hirsch practices in Boca Raton, Florida, and our episode tonight is about clavicles, collarbones, if you will. So let's head on down to South Carolina for our Spring Classics chat with journalist Dan Worry. Hi, Dan. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's Spring Classic time. It is so nice to speak with you.
I call it the most wonderful time of the year. That's right. Hey, Diane, thanks for having me.
Do you really?
I love the Spring Classics.
Well, I guess we need to know some of the big stories from, as you call them, the cobbled classics, and I know you have some.
No, there are two types of classics. There are the cobbled classics that begin the classic season, and then we are in the midst right now of the Ardennes classics, which will be ending this weekend with Liège-Bastogne-Liège. But the cobbled classics, the very famous races, the Tour of Flanders, Paris-Roubaix, all of those races have just come off, and a couple of big stories there. I guess maybe my favorite, I have to admit, was at the Tour of Flanders. We had a kind of a surprise winner at Flanders this year. Alberto Bettiol of EF Education First was the surprise winner. He turned pro in 2014, Diane, and this is his very first pro race win at the Tour of Flanders. So a pretty big race, and now he has overtaken me in the number of pro races won.
and me too.
Yes, and you too. He is, but it was it's always really exciting to see something like this. You might remember back in 2011, same team, though branded under Garmin's name at that point, Johan van Summeren won Paris-Roubaix kind of unexpectedly, and it was a similar sort of situation where we have a rider who's not necessarily the best respected in terms of the belief that maybe he's going to go on to be the winner. These domestiques on the team typically are in more supporting roles, and so Bettiol had the opportunity. He broke away with 14 kilometers to go, and a pretty high-powered chase group behind him did what chase groups are sometimes prone to do in a case like this. And they, if a bigger name maybe had broken away, maybe something might have gone differently. But as it is, they kind of looked at one another and decided who was going to expend the energy to chase him down. And the answer, as it turned out, was nobody.
Right.
Bettiol managed to win, and it's really exciting when kind of an underdog winner takes a big race like that. So that certainly was a big story and a lot of fun at the Tour of Flanders.
I have a question, and I don't know if you can answer it, but it occurs to me now. So when a young rider like this, who's relatively new to the scene, wins a big event like this, how does that change his status within the team and then within the whole season? And does it mean he gets more money?
Well, I suspect there are some bonuses involved in winning a race like Flanders. So definitely some more money and certainly more respect for him within the team. And you know, importantly, I think, you know, a lot of respect within the peloton, as we, you know, as we were saying.
Right.
That the idea that this, you know, this rider who had never won a pro race kind of, you know, went off on a flyer there away from the group, you know, wasn't something that piqued a lot of interest for a short period of time. I can guarantee he will never go off the without having a little more interest. So, you know, but it's really, you know, particularly there in Europe. I mean, to be the winner of a race like the Tour of Flanders, you know, I mean, if he never accomplishes anything again in cycling, you know, I mean, that is the absolute highlight of almost anyone's career in the sport. So
sure.
A really special thing for him.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dan Worry about spring classics because it's that time of year. And he's telling us some of the big stories. What's the next one?
So, you know, I think the next one for me would be Philippe Gilbert at Paris-Roubaix.
Mm-hmm.
You know, former world champion. Gilbert has, you know, seen his career kind of go up and down in recent years. He's been a little bit hit and miss after just a really astonishing run several years ago. But he's just an incredible talent. And you have to be really happy for the guy. I mean, winning Roubaix, like Flanders, is a huge achievement. But in the case of Philippe Gilbert, this may be even a little bit more so. You know, I know I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but in cycling, there are certain historic one-day races that we call the monuments. There are five of them, right? So there's Milan-San Remo, the Tour of Flanders, Paris-Roubaix, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, which will happen on Sunday, and Lombardia. And so, you know, those one-day races have a very special history and a very special status. And with his win at Paris-Roubaix, Philippe Gilbert has now won four of the five. He's only missing Milan-San Remo. And only three riders in history, including Eddie Merckx, have actually won all five of those races. So, you know, if I had to guess, I would guess that Philippe Gilbert is going to be spending a lot of time scouting out the Milan-San Remo course over the next year to see if he can't put the cap on that. It's kind of funny. I don't know if you saw this on Twitter. John Bradley, who is our former editor at Velo News, had a great tweet about this. He was talking about his wife. Do you know what an EGOT is, Diane?
An Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony.
That's exactly what. So there's only a handful of people who have kind of won all of those, you know, all of those big prizes in entertainment. So the joke was sort of that Gilbert is sort of, you know, closing in on cycling's version of winning the EGOT. So,
how old is Gilbert now?
Oh, gosh, I don't have that exactly in front of me, but he's, you know, he's in his mid-30s at least.
Well, he still has a chance. I think he can do it. What the heck? Yeah. Let's put it out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, maybe the biggest story that came out of the Cobbled Classics this year is Matthew Vanderpoel. You know, this kid is just incredible. He's 24 years old, you know, had an amazing win last Sunday at the Amstel Gold Race, where he kind of came from behind and passed Julian Alaphilippe and Jakob Fuglsang. You know, right at the end, there was a really, really exciting finish to that. But, you know, when you consider that win at Amstel Gold and put it on top of three other early season one-day races that he won. So he's, you know, he's won four of these early season races, just really on fire. Vanderpoel is actually the two-time world cyclocross champion. He is he won the world championship title in cross back in February. So he is the reigning cyclocross champion. And has just absolutely destroyed it on the roads here. And, you know, he is not even on a world tour team, 24-year-old kid. He's on a on a Belgian team called Corendon Circus. You know, so, I mean, talk about a rising star. And then just a really interesting story to watch with him. You know, his season, you know, you could make the argument that winning the Cyclocross World Championship would be enough for 1 year. But he, you know, he comes in, he wins these 4 one-day races here in the spring. He is about to suspend his road season, interestingly enough, because he is going into the mountain biking World Cup series. So he has the possibility of being both the cross championship, both, you know, both the world champion in cyclocross, the world champion in mountain biking. And now there is discussion, though there hadn't been a plan to do this earlier, that he might come back and actually race the road worlds later in the later.
Wouldn't that be cool? A triple crown. That would be so cool.
Yeah, it really it is unusual to be in a situation like that, but it, you know, it has happened from time to time, and so we'll you know, we'll have to watch that story. But boy, Matthew Vanderpoel is definitely a name to watch.
No kidding. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Dan Worry. We're talking about Spring Classics. We're going to move on to kind of a mention that I haven't mentioned. I don't think I've even mentioned him at all this year, which is really shame on me. What's up with Mr. Sagan?
Yeah, Peter Sagan, you know, it's really kind of interesting, isn't it, that we would even have this conversation?
Yes.
Because for any other rider, you know, we wouldn't really be dreaming of having this conversation of like, you know, why didn't Peter Sagan win all of the most difficult one-day races in the world? But he is such a talent and has been so dominant in recent years that it actually does seem sort of odd in a way for him to, you know, not be listed as the big winner, or at least one of the big winners coming out of the classic season. Last year, you might remember he won again, Wevelgem, and of course then had a big win at Paris-Roubaix. This year has been a little slower for him, maybe a little bit more disappointing. And again, only for Sagan would we call what he has actually done this season disappointing. You know, he was fourth at Milan-San Remo. He was fifth at Paris-Roubaix. So he's been right in the mix, but has just not been able to put it together to land on the top step of any of these races so far. So that's, you know, that's the kind of where Sagan is. He's had some disappointments there too. Last Sunday at Amstel Gold, he abandoned the race. This week at Flesh Wallonne, he also had to abandon.
Hmm.
He's dying to race at Liège this weekend, but has pulled the plug on that at this point. Not sure if he's just tired or if there had been some injury associated with some of those abandonments.
But yeah, begin to wonder.
Yeah, he's decided against racing this weekend. He's going to take a little rest, and then his next appearance will be at the Amgen Tour of California in early May. You know, and he's got a great history there of really, really lighting things up. And then, of course, you know, there's a lot of season to go, including the tour. He'll be, you know, in the running for his seventh green jersey this year. He's got 11 Tour de France stage wins, so still plenty of season to go, and, you know, a remarkable talent. But it's you know, it's interesting and kind of exciting to see someone, you know, it really has not been since Sagan that someone like Matthew Vanderpoel has shown up and really just sort of set the world on fire. So it's, you know, it's always exciting to see another kind of young phenom show up into the mix. And that'll be a great rivalry, I suspect, in the years to come.
Can you stay with me? We're going to take a real quick break and we'll come back and we're going to talk about women.
Sounds good.
Okay, hang on. We've been talking with Dan Worry. We're going to take a real quick break. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back. If you're just joining me, rewind. That way you'll know what's been going on in the Spring Classics with Dan Worry. So, Dan, we have been talking about all the men and everything they've been doing. What's up with the women? What stands out for you during the Classics with women?
You know, it's sort of along the lines of what we were talking about with Sagan and Vanderpoel. The women's season in the throughout the Classics has been really kind of interesting to watch as well. In recent years, you might recall, Diane, that the Bowles Dolmans team has been such a dominating force, just, you know, winning races right and left.
Right.
And there's really kind of a nice mix this season with, you know, with several teams and several riders that have you know, really sort of shared in the glory. I think it goes to show that the women's sport, you know, just is continuing to grow in its quality and in its popularity. And so, you know, a lot of great things happening. Last weekend, we had a televised Amstel Gold on the women's end. Kasia Niewodoma had a terrific win at Amstel Gold, just really managed to wait for just the right moment and attacked there toward the end, and, you know, managed to drop people like Mariana Voss, which is not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, no kidding.
As you probably know. So it was a, you know, an impressive win. Annemiek van Vleuten won at the Strade Bianche, which was very impressive. Marta Bassanelli at the Ronde van Drenthe. You know, so, you know, it's been and Voss herself had a great win at the Trofeo Alfredo Binda. So good stuff going on. But, you know, I think the big story in the women's sport is just sort of right now the diversity of great winners that are really lighting things up.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, I spoke with Katie Hall, and, you know, she was in Girona. She was in Spain training, but ready to go for her first season with the Bowles Dolmans team. So it'll be fun to watch her too.
Well, I tell you, Katie is a tremendous talent, and so absolutely is somebody to keep an eye on.
Sure, sure. So we have more coming up, the Ardennes Classics and the Giro. Who's looking good for those for you?
Well, so we'll, you know, we'll see, you know, Bastogne-Liège this weekend.
Right.
And, you know, we're looking at the Tour of California and the Giro. You know, as far as Liège goes, I mean, you know, Philippe Gilbert has been somebody who, you know, really has made his mark in the Ardennes Classics in the past and is obviously on tremendous form, you know, having won Paris-Roubaix. So, you know, I certainly would be keeping an eye on him. Greg Van Avermaet is another, you know, another big name in the one-day races who hasn't been quite as dominant this year, but, you know, we'll see where that goes. And then you're right, the Giro is kind of right around the corner and will be interesting to watch this year. You might recall last year, you know, Chris Froome managed to sort of come back, snatch victory from the
yes
defeat last year, and it was, you know, it was really interesting. Simon Yates last year of Mitchelton Scott was in the race and, you know, in the pink jersey for more than 2 weeks at the Giro, and really looked to be the winner of that race before Chris Froome had that, you know, sensational attack on the 19th stage and just really kind of threw the race into disarray. And so it'll be, you know, especially interesting, I think, to watch Yates this year. Bradley Wiggins says that he believes that Yates is going to be the winner this year, and I generally take Sir Bradley's word on these things. He's got a bit of experience. You know, another interesting thing to watch will be Team Sky. You know, Froome, you know, was very successful at the Giro last year, but then did not win the Tour de France, and so he is sitting the Giro out. Egan Bernal of Team Sky is going to be leading the team this year, and that'll be an interesting thing to watch in and of itself. He, you know, he debuted. His Grand Tour debut, at least, was last year at the Tour. He was 21 years old, managed to come in second in the Best Young Rider competition last year, you know, while he was supporting Froome and obviously the eventual winner, Geraint Thomas. So, you know, less than a year later, here we are. And, you know, this very young guy, very talented guy, will be leading Team Sky, you know, as they go into the Giro this year. So, you know, interesting to watch. And then, you know, we've got people like Vincenzo Nibali and Tom Dumoulin, who are always interesting to watch in the mix. So the Giro ought to be great to watch as well.
Yeah. And then, of course, as we move into summer, we've got the big stuff coming, especially the Tour. You got any predictions on that this year?
Well, you know, I mean, to me, the most interesting story going into the Tour is really going to be what happens within Team Sky. We've got Froome as a, you know, a multi-time, you know, kind of consecutive winner of the Tour, who was a little bit off last year. His teammate, Geraint Thomas, you know, won the Tour and, you know, is coming back in this year as the defending champion. So, you know, it is a little bit reminiscent now of the, you know, of the Bradley Wiggins, Chris Froome situation at Sky, where, you know, they have these, you know, two incredible riders, you know, either of whom would be very capable of leading the team. By all accounts, Froome and Thomas have a much better relationship than Wiggins and Froome did, but still to, you know, to have two defending Tour champions on one squad, you know, will be especially interesting to watch and see how that plays out in Team Sky. I don't think they're ready to tell us yet.
Right. And what about Amgen? What do you think is going to happen there? Any predictions on Amgen, which is coming up?
I definitely think that, you know, Sagan has an amazing shot. He has won, you know, stage after stage at Amgen in the past, and, you know, has had a comparatively quiet year, but still, you know, is coming in fifth at Paris-Roubaix is absolutely nothing to sneeze at. So, you know, obviously he's on good form and just hasn't had the good luck yet to sort of put things together. So, you know, if I had to predict, I would anticipate seeing quite a few stage wins from Peter Sagan in California.
Well, they are moving the rates a little further south, so there are going to be some different climbs this year from what I understand. So we'll have to watch and see.
We will see.
Well, and what are you working on for Velo News, if anything?
Continuing to, show up on the back page every now and then. I'm not in there monthly at this point, but, you know, pitching in where I'm needed and as I'm able.
We will probably try to catch up again right around tour time, if that's good with you.
That sounds terrific.
All right. And as always, thank you so much for such great insight into the Spring Classics and what we might expect coming up. Dan Worry, journalist and really good guy. I love your work. Thank you so much for it.
Thanks so much, Dan. All right. See you soon.
Have a good one. Bye-bye. Dan Worry joined me from his office in South Carolina. You can find Dan's fun and informative commentary at the back of Velo News. And we will check back with him as the season keeps rolling along, getting closer to the tour in July. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back to talk with Hall of Famer, rancher, and an all-around cool chick, Inga Thompson. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back, and you are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Inga Thompson loves the bicycle world, and even though she hasn't raced professionally in many years, she's kept informed and active, often saying her piece in public. Now she's back to support up-and-coming women cyclists with her new project, the Inga Thompson Foundation. Here's my conversation with Inga. Hi, Inga. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, you know, we've been waiting to have this conversation. It's been a while, and you have an announcement to make. Tell us what's changed for you since the last time we spoke.
Well, since the last time we spoke, I own an operational cattle ranch. I had it mainly horse-powered, but, you know, I have my tractors and backhoes and heavy equipment, and we did the baling. But I sold my cows and got out of the business. So I still have my ranch. You know, we still have cattle on the place, but I lease out. So it's given me a lot of free time. Yeah. So got out of the cows and tried to enter the next venture of life.
And then you decided to start a foundation. And you and I have talked about working with women in cycling in the past. And now there is the Inga Thompson nonprofit organization, the foundation. Tell us about it, why you decided to start it, and who's going to benefit from it.
Well, it's just been started up, so it's still in its infancy phases. But the concept is to have a somewhat of a financial support group for up-and-coming women cyclists. And that was the original idea, was to bring in funding, and we've kind of run into a few, you know, conceptual snags of, you know, how do you actually help out these women? And I think the biggest is just the funding not there yet, nor have I really worked on it yet, knowing me doing, you know, a lot of different business ventures. But, but like I said, but the concept was to financially help out the women. The way what your concept is and what actually happens turns out to be two different things, you know, I guess as things kind of grow and morph. And I think one of the first fun projects that we have is there's a race here locally called the Baker City Cycling Classic. And I love working with these guys because they have equal distance for the women, but just as importantly, they have equal prize money. And so it was fun, for instance, with this to do a fundraiser of let's have the very first race ever where we have equal distance for the men and the women, but the women actually had a bigger prize list. And it wasn't huge, but it helped these women that are so invested into their sport, and they put in all these, you know, miles and distance, you know, for so very little. So we're kind of trying to make, you know, little milestones with the few funds that we have. But that was like a good first, you know, fun start. And sometimes it's just an airplane ticket, you know, help with getting a trainer, just the little things. But this business will definitely need to grow before I can make any, you know, sort of an impact.
Well, I don't know. I think you make an impact every day. From my perspective, I watch what's going on with you. So how are you determining who might be eligible for some assistance?
It's a woman that has our criteria has been a woman that has shown that she's trying to get onto the national circuit. She wants to go to a qualifying race and then help them out financially there. But so far that's all been limited just because of, you know, limited funds. But that right now has been the focus that I have wanted to go.
Yeah. And I think it's a really good one. As the foundation begins to grow and prosper, what are some of your long-term goals?
Well, one that has kind of come up as far as long-term goals, yeah, that's a good one. Every time I want to set one of those long-term goals, you know, life kind of shifts and changes. It's like, well, what's that idea? You know, you have to reboot and start all over again. Well, not start all over again, but right now is trying to set up an advocacy group for Rebecca Twigg and to, you know, somehow try to figure out how to productively financially help her. And so we're still in the process of putting together a little bit of a, I don't want to say a committee, but a little, you know, think tank of how do we really help her. And I'm sure you've read the Seattle Times article where she's homeless now.
Well, we actually reported on it. I've had conversations with George Mount, and it's been very difficult to reach out to Rebecca because she's been very reticent to talk to other people. I was thrilled to see the Seattle Times article because she actually spoke with somebody.
It's a start that she's starting to speak with somebody. You know, a lot of us have tried to really, really help her keep her privacy, but when she spoke out, it was such a great first, you know, first sign, first step. So what we're trying to do is to, what I would like to do is to hire an advocate for her, and that will take money, and help walk her through trying to get the SSI, you know, benefits to give her a hand, you know, but this is difficult because she has to have an address, has to have a bank account. And how do you do that? So it's one of these things where, you know, she's falling through the cracks. You know, if you don't have a home address and a bank account number, how are we going to help you? And so we're kind of trying to, you know, get through some of those stumbling blocks of how we do this.
You know, it's interesting. I had a conversation with somebody a couple of weeks ago who runs, and you're going to laugh, it's called the Boob Ride. It's for breast cancer.
Uh-huh. I love it.
I know. And it's in California, but what they do, and I don't know if this would work, what they do is they work with local social workers, raise the funds with their events, and the social workers reach out to their clients and do things like get them transportation to chemotherapy or get them home health care, health aids. And I'm wondering if maybe there's something in the in the mental health or social worker network that would help Rebecca. I mean, she was such an amazing force in our bicycle world.
The first step is that they have to want to have help.
That's
true.
And
with Rebecca, I don't think people understand this, that I have spoken to more than a dozen people that have really tried to intervene and really tried to be there. They've provided her a home, and she'll stay for a couple of weeks, and then she goes back to the streets, trying to provide her a job, and then she'll say, "Well, you know, obviously I can tell that you really don't need me. You're just trying to give me money, you know, stuff like that." And then she leaves and she disappears. And how do you work with that?
Yeah, it's tough.
Really, really difficult to try to work with that. So, you know, the two different ideas I have at the moment are either set it up that she can go to if we can't get her an advocate to get her the benefits, then to one of the homeless shelters that she frequents always have. It's going to have to be cash, because if she doesn't have a bank account, you can't give her a check, but just make sure that she knows that there's a little bit of money there every month to get her through the month.
That's a great idea.
Because throwing money at somebody, like a huge chunk amount, probably isn't going to work.
It'll overwhelm her.
It would be overwhelming. Where is she going to keep it? There would be fear of having cash on hand and, you know, having it stolen. It just sets you up for a whole other set of anxiety. So if we can't do some type of benefits for her, you know, through the Social Security or all the different alphabet name soup that comes behind all of this, is just to make sure that she has a little bit of cash every month. So whatever ends up coming in, just, you know, for instance, I think $100 would every month, because right now I think I've raised a little over maybe about $2,500. Well, if you gave her $100 a month for the next 25 months, it's not the long-term solution, but it helps. I would rather put that money into hiring an advocate to get her on benefits so she has that for the rest of her life. That's a whole other challenge.
It is a whole other challenge. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Inga Thompson. We've been talking a little bit about Rebecca Twigg, and, you know, I don't think she is completely an example of what happens to some athletes. And she was such an astounding athlete. She's very bright. She was in college at the age of something like 14. So it's clear that she's got some issues that aren't going to be resolved overnight. But I think that the idea, you have a page on your foundation website that will take donations for Rebecca. And we'll talk more about that toward the end of our conversation. I want to talk a little bit about how you see women's racing right now. When we spoke in November of 2014, you had just been inducted into the National Bicycle Hall of Fame. And you had some very clear memories of your time in women's pro racing and some pretty strong words for why you left the sport. How do you see women's racing today? Have things changed? Do you see it cleaner? And do you see some parity happening?
Well, I won't speak with the drugs stuff, because I'm now out of the loop long enough that I don't even know what to say there. But what I will address, though, one of my concerns was, you know, we still don't have TV coverage. We still don't have guaranteed minimum wage for the women through the International Cycling Union. There was a lot of things nothing had progressed for the women. If anything, we were losing all these big stage races. There was no World Cup. And what I think is interesting is a lot of us got really vocal about this on Facebook about, what do you mean there isn't a minimum wage, and how come it hasn't been developed, and how, you know, where that was one of the beautiful things about Facebook is we could get really vocal about this. And so what I see now is when you're watching some of the women's coverage, you're actually starting to see TV coverage, which is huge. I've always felt like once we start getting the press, then the sponsorship will come. The other thing that has happened is that they now have a World Cup series, and that's huge. And so I think with the TV coverage, you're going to start getting better salaries. So if anything, in the last 4 years, I've actually seen some improvements that I think is that it's going to be the tipping point to these women are really going to start benefiting. And I think we're starting to see that. So I feel a lot more positive about women's racing in general. I feel really positive about it from where it was like 5 years ago. You know, on the downside, I have a lot of reservations with allowing, you know, transgenders to start competing with the women. And I hope that won't adversely affect it.
Tell me about that. I didn't even think about it. I mean, I've sort of glanced at it, but I haven't really thought deeply about it.
It's going to, I'm sure it was a panel of, it sounds really awful, but a panel of men that said, yeah, we think it's okay. If you take away their testosterone levels, they can race with the women. And my argument to that one is, taking away a man's testosterone level doesn't make him a woman any more than if a woman was to take testosterone, that would make her a man. It just isn't fair. My feeling is that you may move up a category, but you may not move down a category. So like as a woman, I don't get to go race with the junior women because I'm feeling a little young today.
Right. That's a good point.
A 14-year-old doesn't say, hey, I want to compete with the 10-year-olds today. You don't get to move down a category. You may only move up a category. And my argument is as a woman, I raced with the men all the time. So if the transgenders would like to race, that's great. Race with the men. I raced with the men as a woman. You can race with the men as a transgender, but I don't believe that you should be able to move down a category. It'd be like me saying, like, you know, I want to go back and race with the 23-year-old. Well, no. I mean, actually, that would be moving up a category when you think about my age.
Well, but we get the point. We totally get the point that it doesn't compute, that there's an imbalance there that doesn't work.
Right. When you have a body that is genetically male, has been able to grow and mature genetically male, it's going to be, I'm sorry, a superior body because they're genetically male. And taking away the testosterone doesn't make them a woman. Yes, their hormone levels are the same as a woman, but it doesn't put you in the same category. And my fear is all of the progress that has been made for the women, if the transgenders are in there, it's just going to turn into other people are going to be like, oh yeah, let's look at all the derogatory comments that people can say. They're now going to start viewing women's racing, fill in all the derogatory comments that is going to happen. And my feeling is absolutely the trans should be able to race. But start your own category, because the women have been pioneering and fighting forever to get our equality, only to have it poached by the transgenders. I believe that they should race, but you don't get to ride off of our coattails of our hard work. Start your own category.
And I totally see it and agree with it. Really, let me remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with Inga Thompson. What an interesting perspective. And thank you for sort of enlightening me on it, because I really didn't know how to think about it. And, you know, at first you say, oh, of course, transgender, we don't want to discriminate. But then you have the opposite way of looking at it.
I don't want to discriminate. I mean, I have some friends that are, you know, that have all of their different sexualities. I love these people. They're great. They are. I mean, but start your own category, because it's not fair for you to come and race with the women. You have a genetic advantage. It's just not fair. Please race. Just not in our group. Start your own group. We worked really, really, really hard to get all of the equalities that we have. You can do the same.
So here comes that million-dollar question. What is the possibility that the UCI is going to say, well, we're going to have another category in racing called transgender? It means another whole series of races? Or what does that mean?
I don't know, but that's their battle to fight. That's their battle to fight. We have fought a battle for the women to get there, and we had to start that. And we had to have a lot of outspoken women to get equal pay, to try to get the races, to try to get television. We fought for that. And they too can fight to get their equality. But coming and riding off of our coattails isn't right. You know, and you can even see Martina Navratilova. I mean, even she is speaking out saying this isn't right.
Interesting. Yeah, I haven't seen anything she's written, but I certainly understand what you're saying. Let's just real quick get back to your foundation, because clearly Rebecca Twigg is not your only issue, although there is a page for her. What would you like to tell listeners about the work you're doing and how they might participate with you? What are you looking for? And is this for assistance? And you use the term digging deep. What do you need? What do you want?
Right now, what I need to spend time doing is fundraising so that we have the funds so that we can start distributing it to the women. And I haven't started with that fundraising yet. We got this thing all set up last year and kind of tried to get everything set up. And then I went and fell through the floor of my barn and, you know, shattered one shoulder and ripped up the other shoulder.
Oh, so man, I didn't know you did that.
Yeah, so my focus went back to I just need to figure out how to take care of myself, and I'm in no position right now to try to make decisions and stuff like that when you're, you know, on painkillers and surgeries and...
What the hell, Inga?
Yeah, I know, I know. I was fixing unsafe boards in the loft of my barn.
And you had to prove how unsafe they were.
Yeah, the irony. I sit there and I think about being on a cattle ranch and getting taken out by cows and, you know, with all the dangerous things I do, you know, with the extreme skiing, with riding bikes, with, you know, putting up hay with horses, with, you know, cattle chasing me, that it would be my barn that would take me out. You know, I just didn't see that one coming.
Yeah,
you know?
No, but kidding. It's always those things.
I was like, oh, there's some unsafe boards up here, you know, and so I had cut down some trees up in my forest, and I had, you know, skidded them down with the tractors and had them all milled up. So I was ripping out these boards because they're not safe and I needed to put new boards in there. And I just backed up, wasn't paying attention, and went through. And I just think of all the safety measures I have installed on this ranch, and, you know, no injuries have ever happened on a ranch, and it's super, you know, ranches can be dangerous. I mean, you know, I was feeling, you know, somewhat satisfied with all of my safety measures that I have in place. I just didn't. Yeah, I backed up.
Without looking. I backed up without looking. No rear view mirror.
Where was the rear view camera when I needed it?
That is correct. That is correct. Well, let's tell our listeners how to support Rebecca and to support women's racing by giving them the foundation information. And then I'm going to let you get back to hopefully not falling through the floor of your barn again.
You know, I really don't want to do that again. That
no.
Really
no, no, no.
Yeah, there's nothing like dislocating your arm, ripping off the tendons, and then shattering everything.
It was
a really fun combination. Thanks for good stories.
Well, you know what? It's interesting because another person who's on the show with us this week is Dr. Jonathan Hirsch, who's an orthopedic specialist. And we're talking about broken clavicles this week. And so go ahead. Tell us how to find your foundation.
You can find my foundation at Inga Thompson Foundation, one word, .org. And if you have special notes with your donation, then write me an email. And if specifically, if you want it to go towards the foundation of, you know, helping women either get, you know, a plane ticket, you know, and or helping with, you know, supplementing prize lists and or helping with Rebecca.
Perfect. Well, I really appreciate you taking time. I know you're really, really busy. And we'll talk again soon. Good luck with the foundation. Inga Thompson, ingathompsonfoundation.org. Take care of yourself.
Oh, thank you, Diane.
All
you're,
right.
You're the best.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Inga Thompson joined me from her ranch in Oregon. Someday I'm going to get out there and ride one of those gorgeous Frisian horses of hers. If you're interested in supporting Inga, the riders, or Rebecca Twigg, you can log on to ingathompsonfoundation.org. Let's take another short break, and when we come back, we'll speak with Dr. Jonathan Hirsch. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. If you've ever made that awful mistake of grabbing your front brake and pitching over the handlebars, you may have broken your clavicle or collarbone, as most of us say. Dr. Jonathan Hirsch has some wise words about what happens, what to do, and some of the newest treatments available. Hello, Dr. Jonathan Hirsch. Welcome to this show. Thanks for joining me this week.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. So I figured because of your specialty, orthopedic specialty, we would start our spring here in Northeast Ohio and across the U.S. with some of the issues that cyclists come up with when they either fall down, get knocked down, or otherwise get injured while riding.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about Jonathan's background first, and then we'll call this part one of our chats.
So, as you said, I'm an orthopedic surgeon. I practice in South Florida in Boca Raton. I've been practicing almost 20 years. I specialize in sports medicine, so lots of different types of sports injuries. And I am a cyclist, as you know. Luckily, knock wood, I've avoided some of the major injuries I see in my office, but it's such a growing sport, and I have a feeling the injuries will grow with it.
Yeah, probably. And full disclosure, Jonathan and I rode together in an event 2 years ago. We've sort of picked parts of the body, and today we were going to talk about the clavicle, aka the collarbone, and how it tends to be one of the most often broken bones, and how the treatment maybe has changed over the years, or some of the things you're doing now.
Yeah, I mean, the clavicle is a pretty exposed bone, and there's really not a whole lot of protection, muscular protection, and it seems when cyclists fall, the shoulder, the point of the shoulder is very often the first thing that hits the ground. You know, most of us are clipped in, our hands are on the handlebars, and may not even have enough time to break the fall with our hands. So a lot of times the shoulder is what hits first. And so the clavicle can fracture in, you know, so many ways. It's a pretty long bone. And the where it breaks, how many pieces it breaks in, determines or gives us the determination of how we're going to actually treat it. Some of them are surgical. Many of them are surgical. Some of them are not. And so it's an interesting bone that it fractures kind of a little bit different every time. And we have to really individualize the treatment for the patient.
One of the questions that comes up for me is somebody falls, you know, hits her front brake, goes over, breaks a collarbone. Is it immediate that you can tell what happens, or sometimes do things show up later?
A lot of the clavicle fractures that are what we call displaced, if the pieces of the clavicle are not connected anymore, it's pretty obvious. If you run your hand along your clavicle, it's right under the skin. It's a very superficial bone. It's pretty obvious, even to a non-medical person, that their clavicle is probably broken. I do occasionally see a fracture that's basically a hairline fracture, and the bone is not out of place. And it may take a week or two to discover that, because sort of everything hurts sometimes when you fall. But a lot of times it's pretty obvious, and most people notice it, and they think it's going to poke right through their skin, because really that's all that's covering the clavicle. Luckily, I've almost never seen an open fracture where the clavicle was literally poking through the skin. But sometimes it's tenting the skin, and that's a semi-emergency where it's literally pushing up right on the very thin skin there over the collarbone.
Wow. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dr. Jonathan Hirsch. He's an orthopedic sports specialist in Boca Raton. And we're talking about breaking your clavicle, your collarbone, which I know many of my listeners have done. Many of the people I know have done. You know, I hate to call it a rite of passage because that's such a horrible thing. But for cyclists in particular, it seems to happen quite often. So
yes.
What are some of the treatment options that maybe some are newer than others?
So we have, luckily, technology has advanced. You know, what we do most of the time when we're going to operate on these clavicles is use some sort of plate fixation, metal plate with screws. But the technology has got so advanced because the clavicle itself is not a straight bone. You may think it is, but it's actually shaped like an S. So to try to fit a straight plate on a curved bone is almost impossible. So luckily, we now have plates that are shaped, all different shapes and sizes to match the majority of people's clavicles. So you want a plate that sits very close to the bone, not very, very prominent, and actually holds the bone together while it heals. Some of the clavicle fractures are more lateral, more towards the shoulder. They're much more complicated because the clavicle itself is suspended from your scapula or your shoulder blade. So that connection is extremely important. Some clavicle fractures actually disrupt the ligaments that connect the collarbone to the shoulder blade. It requires even additional techniques. And some of them actually are arthroscopic techniques where we can go in the shoulder and we can place sutures or other devices looking at those ligaments from within the shoulder, actually, combined with looking at the clavicle from an incision. So we have gotten very creative and minimally invasive in some of our techniques when the clavicle is not only broken, but separated from the shoulder blade as well.
How often do people get 100% healing, I guess is the word I'm looking for?
So the more shattered the bone is and the more displaced or separated, the less chance they're going to heal without surgery. So the goal is put the two bones back together so they heal. But many can be treated non-surgically. I mean, I've had to really convince some patients as they look at their x-ray and the two bones are barely touching. And if they are close enough, especially in much younger people, you can treat it in just a sling. Now it heals with a little bump, and the person has to be aware that they have a sort of a permanent bump on their shoulder, but they don't necessarily need an operation either. So the clavicle fracture healing rate is very high, but the ones right in the middle can have a high non-union rate if you don't treat it right, up to 20-30%. So we don't want to neglect ones that the bones are basically not touching in the middle portion because they won't heal. And you know, to do a surgery 3 to 4 months later when it didn't heal is just a little bit more complicated. But I do a fair amount of those where it was sort of left alone. And recently I actually fixed a woman who had a clavicle that was 2 years old and had never healed. And those are just, you know, just extremely challenging cases.
Yeah, I'll bet. How often do people not seek treatment quickly enough? That never occurred to me, that somebody would like break something and not go to you.
There's still this sort of old adage that some, I think, emergency rooms say, oh, no clavicles need surgery. I still see patients that go to an emergency room, they diagnose them with a clavicle fracture, and the emergency room doctors are sort of going by some old-fashioned teaching saying, oh, they all heal, you don't need surgery. And they just never go to an orthopedist to take an x-ray to see if it heals. And that's, I've seen 3 or 4 people with that recently, that for years they went with a collarbone that wasn't healed and finally realized it was sort of bothering them or literally moving around and just got bad advice. And so the pendulum has swung that we're being way more aggressive, appropriately aggressive on clavicle fractures now, in that we know we have figured out the ones that necessarily aren't going to heal, or if they heal would be so crooked, would affect the patient's function. So we've had experience in a bunch of long-term research studies to know which ones may turn out bad if you don't fix them.
Yeah, I'm trying to understand why you would break something and not make sure that when it is fixed, it gets fixed, because bones do heal. Let me ask you a weird question, maybe, because I think you know this, that I had some stem cell replacement therapy. Are you using any stem cell stuff? Yeah.
When I have a fracture that is either shattered or like one of these patients where it's a chronic situation and it didn't heal, yeah, we do have bone graft substitutes that have stem cells in them now that we can place inside the fracture or around the fracture at the same times of fixing it with a plate and screws. So, there's a couple of companies that do sell stem cells within a bone graft substitute. Occasionally, I will actually draw blood from someone's iliac crest from their bone marrow, which is just chock full of stem cells right there in the surgery, to, again, just add something to stimulate the bone to heal.
Well, I, for one, can say it works. That's where they took my stem cells from, the iliac crest.
It is.
Well, what is the last thing you might want to say to my listeners about clavicles? And then I will remind our listeners with whom we've been speaking and that you'll be back to talk about another part of the body, and we'll pick one right now. But what else would you say to people about taking care of this collarbone situation, which seems to be pretty prominent among cyclists.
Yeah, I mean, here's a perfect example of what I would say. I'm operating on a girl this Thursday who her original x-ray was non-displaced, just saw a tiny crack. But 2 weeks later, she rolled over in her bed. Something happened, and now it's 100% displaced, and she needed surgery. Now she needs surgery. So the key is follow-up. Don't just say, if the first x-ray looks okay, don't let anyone convince you, oh, it's just going to heal fine. Don't worry about it, because you want to follow it through 100%. You want to follow through that it did heal, let's say, in a sling, or maybe it moved or shifted, and now the treatment has to shift with it. And, some people just maybe take the first or second x-ray and they're done and they don't follow up. And then they wind up with a bone that healed crooked or may have not healed. So the key is follow up. Most people wind up in the emergency room first, but go to an orthopedic specialist that has experience with clavicle fractures, knows how to handle them, how to handle the complications that may arise with them, or treat them if they don't heal.
Awesome. So what's the next body part we're going to talk about the next time you and I get together on the show?
So much to talk about. We can certainly move down to the lower extremity, hip and knee problems, if you'd like.
Sure.
That's certainly a long discussion. Those are some unique, but not so unique to cyclists, the issues of the hip and knee, they're an interest of mine.
Well, you know what? Maybe we'll throw it open to listeners and right on our Facebook page.
Sure. I'm open to questions, however you want to do it.
Well, that was what I was going to say. Is there a way for listeners to contact you if they have questions? And I know you're not certainly nationwide, but I've seen that you've done some videos and some other productions that people can actually listen to you and see you and you talk about some of the things you do. How would they find those?
So a couple of ways. They could go to my website, and there's a fair amount of videos that I've put out, hirschmd.com. So it's HERSCHMD.com. And they could also follow me on Twitter, @HirschMD. And then if they follow me, they can contact me through Twitter if they'd like. That's really an easy platform for discussion.
Perfect. We've been talking with Dr. Jonathan Hirsch. He's an orthopedic specialist in Boca Raton, Florida. Well, I hope you're training for your ride this fall.
Yes.
And thank you so much for talking with us today. We will talk again soon. And have a wonderful week.
Thank you so much, Diane.
All right. Take care. Dr. Jonathan Hirsch joined me from his office in Boca Raton, Florida. If you're interested in his work or have questions for him, you can log on to his website, jonathanhirschmd.com. Dr. Hirsch will be back with us next month when we talk about knees. I hope you enjoyed this week's show. Many thanks to Dan Worry, Inga Thompson, and Dr. Hirsch for joining me this week. Next week, we'll be talking about record-breaking speed with Denise Mueller-Koronek. We'll also be tiptoeing through the tulips with journalist, adventure swimmer, botanist, and more, Suzanne Masters, as we talk about her New York Times article, Chasing Rembrandt's Tulips on Two Wheels. Thank you so much for listening, and thanks for being a loyal fan. I'm very honored and humbled to be able to do this work and to celebrate 450 podcasts. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe, and if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.